Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the surprise victory of Prime Minister Netanyahu, who won a fourth term as Israel's leader in an election that pollsters said was very tight, but nevertheless Netanyahu's Likud party clinched a convincing win, making Netanyahu Israel's longest-serving prime minister. Gideon Levy, an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz, who is the former spokesman for Shimon Peres, joins us to discuss the consequences of Netanyahu's last-minute racist appeals to overcome the Arab vote and his vow to ultra-nationalist right-wing voters that he would not create a Palestinian state. Then we will look into what is expected to be an even stronger and more coordinated alliance between Netanyahu and the Republican Congress in thwarting President Obama's efforts to make a deal with Iran and stifling any chance of a peace settlement between Israelis and Palestinians. MJ Rosenberg, a special correspondent with the Washington Spectator and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post, joins us to discuss the extent to which a newly empowered Netanyahu and an implacably hostile Republican Congress can block Obama's pending deal with Iran. Then finally, we'll go to Tunis, Tunisia, to get an update on the terrorist attack at a prominent tourist attraction in which 20 European tourists were killed and up to 50 were wounded. Masoud Ramadani, World Forum organizer and member of the Committee for the Maghreb Regional Social Forum and a Tunisian researcher on the uprisings in the region, joins us to discuss this latest attempt to impede Tunisia's post-Arab Spring path to secular democracy and the likelihood that the massacre was carried out by some returnees from the 3,000 Tunisians who have gone to Syria or Iraq to wage jihad with the so-called Islamic State. And joining us now from Israel is Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's a former spokesman for Shimon Peres, and Gideon Levy writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and has been doing so for the past 25 years. His latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gideon Levy.
Thank you.
And last night, things clearly changed in the middle of the night. The last reporting we did was that the polls were neck and neck, but then now Prime Minister Netanyahu has apparently won a surprise victory. Well, let's begin with the exit polls. What happened there, do you think?
It's a mystery. It might be just lack of professionality. It might also be that people misled them. But this is behind us. It's not really important.
Sure.
Real results are with us, and they are totally different than what we thought. And that's the new reality, and this should be, and this is what matters, and not what
is of course.
Yesterday's news.
It doesn't matter, and in fact, already the White House has expressed grave concern and disappointment over the polarizing rhetoric that came out of the election at the last minute. Your former boss, Shimon Peres, recently remarked that the choices for Israel were between Herzog and Livni, who want to continue to try and arrive at some kind of peace process, and the Likud narrative under Netanyahu, which is apparently that they just want to somehow manage the status quo. And as far as I can see, the status quo is unmanageable vis-a-vis the Palestinians.
First of all, there is no status quo in this part of the world. Because even what seems to be a status quo is not a status quo because things are changing all the time. For example, Israel is continuing building settlements. This is not status quo. This is changing reality. But in any case, the results of the elections are very clear, and the Israeli people said its words, and Netanyahu will continue to be the prime minister. And anyhow, there are no expectations whatsoever for any kind of peace process.
Well, I was just hearing a report on NPR. They interviewed a young woman in Jerusalem who said that she hopes for peace and for economic equality in Israel. And it would seem that both of those issues were voted down.
Yeah, this lady is hoping, but I don't know what kind of peace does she mean to. Peace is a very nice word, but before peace there must be justice, and justice is not here. And the fact is that most of the Israelis voted against justice.
Do you know what they voted for?
They voted for continuance of this policy in which the occupation continues forever. One people is living without any rights under the rule of Israel for almost 50 years. Continuance of building settlements, of racism, of discriminating the Israeli-Palestinian population. Continuance of military aggression of Israel. They voted for all this.
So that, does that mean then that Netanyahu and Likud and the right-wing coalition that he'll put together is not required to have a end game? Is that, because that appears to be the thing that's always been puzzling to me, is that there's never been an end game. There's never been a clear, you know, a discussion about where the settlements end, what the right in Israel wants to do with the Palestinians, as though somehow they're going to one of these days just sort of slink off into Jordan somewhere.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. They don't have a plan, and their only plan is something very vague, namely gaining time, so to say, and waiting until something will happen which will make the Palestinians vanish.
Well, that's not going to happen. So that's the part of it that I find a little unreal. And at the last minute, Netanyahu, in effect, made an extraordinary statement that he thought that if he voted, that the Arab vote was going to somehow unseat him and bring in a left-wing government, implying somehow that there was something wrong for in terms of Arabs voting in a democracy. And I always understood that that was one of Israel's strongest points, in the fact that it is a democracy in an area with really hideous governments in the neighborhood, either military dictatorial kleptocrats or medieval monarchs.
This is all true, but not anymore, because we have this government now for so many years, and the understanding of democracy is different.
So what do you think will happen with the Israeli Arabs? Will there be any further marginalization?
No doubt, but now they are united with a rather big party of 14 seats, the third biggest party in the Israeli parliament. And I think this is a very, very interesting and positive development, which might prevent some of their plans to push them to the corner and to go on in discriminating them.
And in terms of Livni and Herzog, the Zionist Union leaders, do you think they have any plans for some kind of comeback, or are they just licking their wounds?
They don't have much choice right now. They were really beaten, and now they have to wait for the next chance, which might be in 4 years' time or earlier, but right now there is very little they can do.
So what could change the political landscape in Israel as it moves further to the right? Do you think there's some kind of reckoning at the end of the day here? Because if you don't have a plan, and as you mentioned, it's not so much a status quo, it's a status quo designed to make a Palestinian state less and less likely as more and more settlements are built. The Palestinians aren't likely to go along with that. What kind of Israel do you see in 4 years' time, Gideon Levy?
I don't see much hope for any kind of improvement, because I don't see any incentive for improvement. And the only way to change things is by an international intervention, which I also don't see happening, at least not in the coming future. So I guess we will go on in the same path, which will not bring Israel to very good places.
But what happened to the pocketbook issues that many analysts said were dominating the Israeli election until Netanyahu came over and spoke to the Congress and sort of changed the subject a little bit away from domestic economic issues to foreign policy issues, particularly Iran? It's always been pretty clear for the longest time that Netanyahu would rather talk about Iran and certainly not talk about the Palestinians. Now he's basically said the Palestinians are off the table. What about the pocketbook issues? Surely they're still on the table.
Yeah, they're still on the table, but you can trust Netanyahu that he will find his way out of it.
So, in other words, there's not going to be any reversal of the growing income disparity, where more and more billionaires and plutocrats have more and more power, not unlike what's happening here in the United States. I thought that Israel being a more vibrant democracy than the United States, there'd be more pushback from the middle class.
I'm not sure it is.
Mm-hmm. You think somehow that the population has drunk the Kool-Aid, that empowering the rich somehow trickles down?
Look, those are issues that are being discussed here, but still the rich ones are far too powerful in order to really make a change. But this might, after a really long period of time, might change gradually.
But at the moment, it's a big victory for Sheldon Adelson, right?
Absolutely.
And
another one.
How much do you think the free newspaper dedicated to Netanyahu that he's published in Israel was a factor?
No, I don't think it is a factor in terms of a game changer. And it's very hard to really to judge. They had their effect, but it's very hard to say, to point, this is the effect and this is not the effect.
Well, you would think, though, that all we've heard from the White House so far is that they are very concerned and troubled by the strident and divisive rhetoric coming from Netanyahu. It's difficult to see any kind of working relationship between Obama and Netanyahu, but we know that essentially Netanyahu's working with the Republicans in the Congress. And do you expect that alliance to get stronger and more defiant of anything that the president's trying to do?
Yes, because I think Netanyahu will now feel even stronger than before after this victory, and he will allow himself to go on with this very destructive policy.
So I guess we can expect more involvement with Republicans in the way that his speech to Congress crossed the line for many people here in the United
States. Absolutely.
So, in any day now, there's going to be an agreement announced, apparently, with Iran, assuming it happens. How do you think that's going to be received?
Well, not in a very positive way, but there is very little that Netanyahu can do about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is the P5 plus one. It's the Security Council and Germany. That's the
five.
Six biggest nations on the earth. So
Absolutely.
But maybe that worked in Israel, the idea that Israel's defying the world, you know?
Yeah.
You think that did play, that was an element in Netanyahu's victory, that he's standing up against the P5 plus one?
Sure. Not only standing up against them, but also caring about the existence of Israel, saving Israel from an Iranian bomb, shooting, and then changing the discourse from economical issues to security issues.
Well, but in the terms of the neighborhood, if the news of Netanyahu's victory is bad news for you and others on the left in Israel, the neighborhood is still on its own trajectory. And one of the things that seems to be happening now is, even though the U.S. is trying to wage a war against the so-called Islamic State, they're in effect already in an alliance with Iran in Iraq, and they look like they're going to negotiate with Assad and perhaps empower Hezbollah. And at the end of the day, it would seem to me that there's obviously the idea that the Islamic State is a few thousand of these sort of Mad Max marauders driving around in that huge part of the world has never made any sense to me. This has to be more than a few thousand jihadis occupying Mosul. This is the Sunni who are being squeezed. And at the end of the day, where do the defeated Sunnis go, assuming that they get squeezed from one side by Hezbollah and the other side by Iran? Isn't that neighborhood likely to get even more dangerous in terms of the Salafism?
Oh, you are taking me now to areas which I feel less confident talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Anything.
Well, it's just, you know, this is what I try to follow in terms of foreign policy.
Sure.
And I get the opinion or get the impression here, Gideon Levy, that you're a little depressed.
Ah, there are no many reasons to be happy.
Right. Well, what can you do, though, to buck up your spirits here?
Very little.
Oh, boy. Well, I guess we should end on that note. I'm sorry that the results didn't turn out the way you were hoping.
Sure.
But what can you do? It is a democracy.
Absolutely.
And I thank,
absolutely.
And I thank you for joining us, Gideon Levy.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's a former spokesman for Shimon Peres, and he writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, and has been doing so for over the last 25 years. And his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into what is expected to be an even stronger alliance between Netanyahu and the Republican Congress. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is MJ Rosenberg, who's a special correspondent with the Washington Spectator and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years and previously served as the director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of the Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, MJ Rosenberg.
Thank you.
And I just was speaking just prior to talking with you now with Gideon Levy with Haaretz in Israel, and I must say it was fairly funereal. Obviously, the Israeli left is stunned and deeply unhappy.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't say that I feel any different. I mean, the difference is that, you know, I'm an American and I live here, and it's not quite as immediate. Though it's pretty immediate because this obviously affects us as Americans as well, particularly in looking ahead at the Iran negotiations and what damage a newly empowered Netanyahu can do.
And I suppose then you inferring, MJ, that what we saw with this letter from the 47 Republican congressmen and Netanyahu's appearance in the Congress shortly before the election, which was done without consulting the Democrats or the White House, could we expect more of that? Will that kind of activity be ramped up?
Oh, I expect it will be ramped up. I mean, it's there is no reason for Republicans to back down. I mean, the only reason would be doing the right thing. And that is not something that they're very interested in ever doing. Their goal is to embarrass the president, and and to make every Democratic or Obama endeavor fail. And I'm sure I read the papers. I mean, they are excited about their boy Netanyahu, winning this thing. And I think they're going to. It could be harder. I don't know. It could be harder now for Obama to prevail. I mean, after all, you don't need that many Democrats. You have all the Republicans are going to vote to override any veto that Obama imposes on new Iran sanctions or anything, any other deal killer. And you know, you've got the Menendez and Cain and Virginia and a few others who will join the Republicans on it. I don't know. I think it looks pretty bad.
Well, when you say Netanyahu's their boy, it seems to me that more than anything, Netanyahu's Sheldon Adelson's boy, and that Adelson, of course, was there very prominently featured when Netanyahu spoke to the Congress recently, and you got the impression that as the Republicans jumped to their feet so often to applaud the Israeli Prime Minister, it also seemed like they were paying fealty to Sheldon Adelson because he's a huge donor. I mean, how much is the donor network, largely organized through AIPAC, the real factor here?
Oh, no, that is the real factor here. I think, I mean, I say all the time, if it wasn't for the money, and it's you know, Sheldon Adelson is just one, is one donor. He's the biggest Republican donor, or one of the top three Republican donors. But, and he's not associated with AIPAC himself. He considers AIPAC too far to the left. So Sheldon Adelson is his own little Israel lobby. But all these AIPAC donors, most of whom are Democrats, they're going to be all over the place promoting the Netanyahu line. I honestly do not, right now there are, you look at an AIPAC conference and you'll have 350 members of Congress showed up, last time. That's, two-thirds or more than two-thirds of Congress shows up to display, as you use the word, fealty to AIPAC and to Israel. If it wasn't for the AIPAC money, that number would be around 50. I mean, and that's for, I say that from my experience working on Capitol Hill. It is not this great, the House and Senate is not this great repository of love and adoration for Israel. It is a great repository of love and adoration for money. On this issue, just like every other issue, but this issue is a little unique because it's a foreign country. It's a foreign lobby, so which makes it different than, numerous other lobbies that basically buy their support. But it's all about the money.
And again,
it's also one of the reasons that the media doesn't report about it. It's striking to me that you can read all the mainstream media and most of the mainstream blogs and not know that the only interest group in America that opposes this Iran thing, the only interest group that is involved in our political system, gives money to campaigns and all that, is the Israel lobby. If the Israel lobby was supported the agreement, there'd be no opposition to the agreement. The Christian right is irrelevant. They always talk about the Christian right. They don't give money to campaigns. In general, they don't, and they certainly don't give money based on Israel. Their issues are things like abortion, gay rights, anti-gay rights, anti-immigrant, all that. We're talking about, we're talking almost entirely about the Israel lobby being the factor in our, that influences our foreign policy because of the money. Not the votes, the money.
And again, I'm speaking with MJ Rosenberg, who's a special correspondent to the Washington Spectator and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years and previously served as a director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of Near East Report, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, that's AIPAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. So do you think then, MJ, that Howard Kaur, AIPAC's chief, he obviously had a lot to do with Netanyahu's coming to Washington to speak before the Congress, and that was also arranged through Netanyahu's friend, who is a Republican operative, Ron Dermer, Israel's ambassador to the United States. But there's also the possibility, is there not, that Howard Kaur, AIPAC's chief, has been coordinating a lot of this stuff? I'm not even sure that given the close relationship he has with Bill Kristol, whose protege, Senator Tom Cotton, wrote that letter, you kind of feeling that they're busy beavers.
Oh, they're all in it together. I mean, that group, Kaur, Kristol, Tom Cotton, he's more like their tool. He's their puppet rather than being a you know, someone who's smart enough to be pulling the strings. The strings are being pulled by, you know, Netanyahu and Dermer and Howard Koar and Bill Kristol and any number of other, you know, other of these, you know, big shot lobby types. I mean, you look at Bill Kristol. I sometimes wonder: is he really even a conservative? Is he even a Republican? Or is this just the guise he puts on to win conservative support for Israel? I mean, his passion. I mean, if you read his books, I mean, his passion is Israel. And these are single issue kind of people who will, you know, pretend that they care about other things. But it's and there's Bill Kristol on ABC every Sunday pontificating about what's right for America, when in fact, he does, as far as I can tell, he doesn't care at all about what's right for America. His, like Krauthammer and a few others, all he cares about is Israel. And unfortunately, the course that he helps choose for Israel will be disastrous for Israel.
Well, a lot of people have said that U.S. policy towards Israel is a policy of assisted suicide. And that's based upon the idea that the Likud has no end game with the Palestinians. They just want to kind of manage this unmanageable situation indefinitely while they build more settlements and squeeze the Palestinians more. And the other side, the left, the Labor, and the center, they want to continue these negotiations. Well, now, in the last minute scramble to get elected, Netanyahu basically shut the door in an appeal to the ultranationalists that he would never help create a Palestinian state. So that one's dead. And also his racist appeals to get the vote out, you know, warning right-wing voters that the other side was going to bring out the Arab vote as though there was something wrong with, you know, Arabs voting in a democracy. That's led the White House to condemn that racist rhetoric, saying that the rhetoric that seeks to marginalize one segment of their population is deeply concerning as it is divisive, which is what Obama's spokesperson said. As far as I know...
I was going to say, I only hope that the divisiveness or the division between the White House and the government of Israel continues. That is the one thing I'm optimistic that would make, assuming it continues, makes me optimistic. I think that the quote-unquote special relationship between Israel and the United States, which basically is the United States giving Israel carte blanche to do whatever it wants, whenever it wants to whoever it wants to do it to, is bad for Israel, bad for the United States, bad for the Palestinians, and bad for the world. I mean, it would be nice if in these last 16 months of this administration, they're going to let Israel know that it will pay a price for basically spitting in the face of U.S. policy and of the American president. However, I'm not convinced that will happen, particularly because the likely Democratic nominee is Hillary Clinton, who is, her top fundraiser is an Israeli, Chaim Saban, she's pretty well to the right of Obama. So I think that Netanyahu probably, as he looks toward the future, he says, well, I can get through 16 months. Best thing that could happen is a Republican will be elected. But even if not, we'll have Hillary Clinton, and she's our, you know, our good friend. Even though, of course, Hillary Clinton personally cannot stand him. I mean, that I know for a fact because I've talked to her about it. She's pretty open about it when you talk to her. I mean, at least she was. She very much recognizes the reality of Democrats' need for AIPAC money. And she's not exactly an idealist when it comes to money grubbing.
So, but at this point, apart from the condemnation over the divisive rhetoric that I mentioned that Obama spokesman Josh Earnest came out with, has the White House congratulated Netanyahu?
No, I haven't seen that. I don't think they have. Mm-hmm. That made me happy and hopeful. Because the normal Cameron, Prime Minister of UK, he did the traditional congratulations. He doesn't like Netanyahu any more than Obama does, but he did the normal kind of thing. And unless we both missed it, I don't think they have congratulated them. I suppose they could justify that on the grounds that, you know, they haven't formed a coalition yet. But, no, I think it's quite... I mean, Herzog congratulated Netanyahu, which is, you know, he conceded. So, no, I think the White House is still pretty mad. But I think mainly they're worried about the effect on Iran.
Which is,
now that's their biggest thing.
Right, and that's coming to the crunch as well, isn't it, in the next few days, those negotiations?
Yeah, and, I mean, yeah, it's that's, you know, when the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, says he's going to move a bill, you know, so this bill that requires the Congress to approve any agreement, that he is going to move that bill on March 24th. That would be even before the deadline to reach an agreement, which is March 31st. So there's all these things that are going to be coming together. And, you know, I worked on the Hill, as I you know, always say, and I just picture, you know, right now or when members of Congress, of the Senate in particular, are thinking about should they support Obama on the agreement or should they support legislation that would kill an agreement, their staffers are saying to them, you got to be crazy to go, particularly if they're Democrats, you got to be crazy to go up against Netanyahu. It'll cost us in the election. Remember, the entire House is up, you know, every 2 years, lots of senators, a third of the Senate, you know, and I know as a former staffer and as a chief of staff in Congress that you're always looking out for to not offend the money that you count on. You know, you have members of Congress, and the way Democrats are, Israel taking money from the from AIPAC donors is sort of like an easy one for them. It isn't that controversial. People don't even pay that much attention to it. So, and now, so they get all this money, and now it's so, in that, but they have now for the first choice, are you with the United States on this, or are you with Israel? And if you're going to be with the United States and not Israel, you're going to lose money.
But in terms of MJ Rosenberg, in terms of closing the door on the two-state solution, on the decades-long negotiations that the Israelis have had with the Palestinians that the U.S. has tried to broker, those negotiations have always been bipartisan. That's always been the U.S. position. So now that Netanyahu has shut the door, it seems that, you know, it's a question of whether the two-state solution is too difficult to implement or too difficult to abandon. I mean, which way would you go on that?
Well, I think the United Nations is going to play a role in this. I mean, it's a recognition of a Palestinian state by the United Nations. The only reason it's been blocked is because of the U.S. veto. And the U.S. veto has been predicated on Israel's support for a two-state solution. We're always saying, well, we're not going to have the United Nations go ahead. Let's wait and see let the two parties negotiate. Well, now that one of the two parties is ruling it out, that takes the United States off the hook. It does not have to support Israel with a veto anymore, which to me means either one of two things. Either we're going to go along with the rest of the world and Palestine will be recognized, and its flag will fly in front of the United Nations, and you sort of have a state that doesn't control territory, but it's still very significant. Or, just as likely, because that's Netanyahu, he changes his position, and he comes out and he says, you know, under certain circumstances, of course I'm for a two-state solution, and, you know, you can't, that was one statement I said. Because the man really believes in very little, he can say anything. And if the United States is going to be looking for it, is looking to get out of a confrontation with Israel, it can just say, well, okay, we don't love what Netanyahu said, but he made clear that he would, you know, under certain circumstances, accept a deal that provided for 1, 2, 3, 4, and then we're just back where we were. And where we are is that the two-state solution is pretty much dead anyway. It's not like it was viable before. I mean, what I would like to see is that the United States would wind up, you know, we don't use the veto, and the United Nations goes ahead and recognizes a Palestinian state. And you have essentially, you know, a recognized government in exile. And that would be an important, you know, an important step. But I just can't see that happening in the lead up to the 2016 election. So that the Obama administration's going to... permit, you know, a United Nations recognition of Palestine.
So
that would be something,
right? But is that to say, though, that the Israel can always count on the U.S. to veto? But two, do they not care about their isolation in the rest of the world as long as they've got the U.S. on board? Because it's clearly happening. Israel is becoming more and more isolated, and Netanyahu's attack on the Iran deal is basically an attack on the P5+1. That's six of the biggest nations on the earth that are behind this deal.
Well, I would say that the election makes, considering that every Israeli voter knows that that's the case, you know, with this alienation from the rest of the world and all that, and yet I don't know what percentage voted for right-wing parties, but I assume it's, you know, if you put them all together, it obviously should be more than 50% because, you know, the majority did go for the right, that the majority doesn't care about international isolation. The majority in Israel today is a right-wing majority that basically their attitude is all that, it's an old phrase that in Yiddish, it says, it doesn't matter what the Gentiles say, it matters what the Jews do. And the do means, you know, building settlements, being strong, standing firm against the Palestinians. You know, that the right wing in Israel thinks that way. Now, I have to say, there's, you know, the left wing, you know, well, like there's some 40% of Israelis who are, like your last guest, near suicidal over this election. They feel themselves thoroughly disenfranchised. But the majority clearly is a right-wing majority that really doesn't care about what France and Germany and UK and Scandinavia and all the rest, as long as they've got the United States in their pocket, and they think, and with good reason, they think they have the United States in their pocket.
Well, just in closing, MJ Rosenberg, do you expect, obviously Netanyahu is hitting the ground running, forming a coalition. Do you think the Republicans are going to hit the ground running? Because this Iran deal is getting close. Already that letter apparently has had some effect on the negotiations, perhaps not particularly important, but nevertheless it's been mentioned a few times by the Iranians. Do you think it's possible that the Republicans are going to come out with a really big spoiler in conjunction with Netanyahu?
I think that I don't expect that. I think in the end the president and the administration is going to prevail. I think there are enough Democrats who are, you know, there is of course the countervailing pressure of, you know, the money and all that, but there's also the feeling that Netanyahu insulted the United States. Insulted the President of the United States. The White House is gonna put it to them, you know, it's a choice between the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Israel. And although that kind of argument wouldn't cut any ice with the Republicans, it will probably prevent enough Democrats from joining the Republicans so that the President in the end prevails. I expect he'll get the deal, and Netanyahu will just have to live with it. All right, I'm pessimistic about most things, but I'm not pessimistic about that deal. But then again, I don't know, of course, just none of us know exactly what's going on. I'm just assuming if a deal is reached, it's going to be implemented, and it won't be blocked by Congress.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us here today, MJ Rosenberg.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with MJ Rosenberg, who's a special correspondent to the Washington Spectator and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years and previously served as the director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. We're going to take a brief station break and be back and then go to Tunis and Tunisia to get an update on the terrorist attack that killed 20 European tourists. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Tunis in Tunisia is Masoud Ramadani, who is a World Social Forum organizer, a member of the committee for the Maghreb Regional Social Forum, and a Tunisian researcher on the uprisings in the region. Welcome to Background Briefing, Masoud Ramadani.
Thank you.
And the killing of about 20 European tourists at the famous Bardo Museum in the capital, Tunis, has shocked the world, clearly, because the assumption has been that Tunisia is the bright example of success, if you will, in the Arab Spring. At this point, has the Ennahda Party come forward, the Islamist Party, have they come forward and condemned the killings?
Everybody in Tunisia, most political parties have condemned. I'm not sure whether Ennahda, but I'm sure that its political leader has condemned the terrorist attack, and I'm sure that also that all political parties believe that this act is against democracy and against the will of Tunisian people. So everybody condemned it, yeah. It's condemned by civil society, it's condemned by all political parties, and against the full trend of the Tunisian society, which is going to succeed. I think it's a transitional period, as you say.
So is it possible that, given that Tunisian authorities say that up to 3,000 of its citizens have gone abroad to wage jihad in Syria and Iraq, which would be, if that's true, that's the largest number of foreign fighters to join the so-called Islamic State. Is there a possibility that the perpetrators are veterans of the Islamic State in Iraq or Syria?
It's a possibility. You know that there were two problems in Tunisia. The first problem is that there was, during the war of Libya, the Tunisian frontiers were have absorbed a lot of people, and arms coming from Libya at that period, and maybe still there are some arms circulating. And the second, there was a period of laxity and chaos, especially following the revolution, and at that period many arms have circulated. The other problem is that mosques have played an important role during the past 2 years and in shaping those extremist groups, and you are right that Tunisian foreign jihadists are the most prominent in Syria. Yeah, that's a possibility. But anyway, we are in close frontier with the Libya, where there is a chaos, where there is a civil war, and almost every day the Ministry of Interior and the armies are speaking of getting and seizing arms somewhere in the country. And myself, let me tell you something. And myself, I was in Libya with the Federation of the International Federation of Human Rights, the FIDH, and where I have seen that Libya was a space where arms circulate, where the possibility of having arms, whether throughout the country or to Mali or to other places, yeah, there are the arms are circulating in the region and Tunisia is not really far from what is happening in Libya, although that Tunisia has got a specific position where democracy has so far succeeded but is still vulnerable to such terrorist acts.
And again, I'm speaking with Masoud Ramadani, who is a World Social Forum organizer, a member of the committee for the Maghreb Regional Social Forum, and a Tunisian researcher on the uprisings in the region. And he joins us from Tunis in Tunisia, where 20 foreign tourists were killed at a very popular tourist site, the Tunisia's largest museum, built in a 15th century palace. And I think about 50 people were wounded, were they not, Masoud?
Yeah, there are scored, I think, about 30 or 40 people. Still, we don't have the exact number of those who are wounded, but there's a large score of people who are really wounded, and they have chosen their target. And yeah, it's one of the most, let's say, tragic acts that happened in Tunisia, and probably it's not the last one. I mean, there are still possibility of having other terrorist acts in the future. We don't know. But the thing is, the positive thing is that we got from, as an organizer, as one of the organizers of the social forum, is that many people throughout the world and activists from Latin America to Europe to India to Asia to whatever in the world, to the Maghreb region, they are going to come in order to express their solidarity with the Tunisian people and to say that no to terrorism, and to send a message to terrorists to say now we are here and we are to succeed this world, so to ensure the success of the of this World Social Forum, and that message is very important to us.
And I take it you're planning to do a memorial at the site of the shooting, is that right?
Yes. That's what we are going to do tomorrow. Now, today we have called the Tunisian people tomorrow to come in masses tomorrow at 4 o'clock p.m. in Tunisia. We are going to stay there for about 4 hours, and then we are going to light candles to have flowers with us. And then we are going to embassies also, to the embassies of those people who have died, and then again we are going to take with us flowers and to express compassion and solidarity with those people who have died, and to say that we as Tunisians, we refuse such terrorism and such extremism. And anyway, I'm sure that's not going to succeed in Tunisia. Those acts are sporadic, they exist, they are they can happen again, but again, I assure that Tunisia is a country where tolerance is predominant, where transition can succeed, and where democracy can flourish.
Well, this attack, nevertheless, must be a blow to Tunisia's new secular-led government. They vowed to take a tougher line against militants since they defeated the Islamist Ennahda party in the elections last year. And I asked you earlier about whether or not Ennahda has made a statement, because there's been a perception since the killing of the secular politicians Chokri Belaid and Mohamed Brahmi, they were assassinated in 2013, that there hasn't been a sufficient condemnation of those political assassinations. Is that something you feel?
I feel, but I think we have to make a distinction between two things. I mean, the killing of Brahmi and the killing of Chokri Belaid is one thing in which there are terrorists, and maybe there are some other bosses who are involved. We still don't know, but we hope that now things are going to be clarified with this new government. But anyway, I think Ennahda had benefited to condemn such acts, and I think that there were two periods in the history of Tunisia. The first period is when Ennahda tried to take profit from those extremist groups, and that was during the 2011 elections, but then there was a period where there was a clear-cut distinction between the two, and that happened when the attack of the American embassy and then the killing of Chokri Belaid, etc., and this has established a clear divorce between the two parties, between those extremist groups who said, first thing, that Tunisia is not a jihad place, but a country of preaching, and then they changed their ideas, etc. And Ennahda would like to sell itself as a party that is moderate, with tolerant Islam, and doesn't like really very much, at least on appearance, to lose face and to be considered as a party that is with violence, with extremism, etc. So I don't think that another now is involved in such acts, or that it's at least its leaders they are going to condemn, and maybe have condemned. I haven't read that yet, but I know that the spokesperson and the leaders, one of the leaders, I heard them, they condemn firmly what happened.
So as a Tunisian, Massoud, how do you see the future? Because as I mentioned in the beginning, you know, Tunisia has been the sort of the bright spot, if you will, in the so-called Arab Spring, which has clearly been reversed, particularly with the counter-coup by General Sisi in Egypt, and which is clearly financed by the Saudis, who don't want any form of political Islam to survive, because obviously it competes with their sort of almost medieval monarchy that they run. How do you see the future there in terms of what just happened today and the general alarm that's felt around the world that there could be, you know, progress being made in Tunisia could be set back?
I tell you something. Last year I was in Washington, and I spoke to many friends over there, including Carnegie and many other places. And I said that, and all they tell me is that Tunisia is not Syria or Libya. I said, no, you don't have to compare that. Tunisia has got a very strong, resilient civil society that has pushed to a constitution that is very progressive, where there is equality, where there is the freedom of conscience, etc. So Tunisia has got a tradition of Islam that is totally different from Saudi Arabia or any other region, because in Tunisia, and this our friends have to know this, that Islam has to adapt to the conditions of Tunisia, to the civilization of Tunisia, and not that it's not Tunisia that has adapted itself to Islam. So Islam in Tunisia is very moderate, tolerant, open-minded, etc. And if you know something, that the leaders of Islam preachers in the 1956, they were the leaders that helped to have the code of personal status where it forbids polygamy and repudiation, etc. Tunisia is a country where in the 19th century it has the first constitution in the Arab world. Tunisia is the country that abolished slavery years before the United States. So Tunisia has the possibility and the ability to overcome this and to constitute its democracy, and civil society is there to help, and political parties are also open-minded, and secularism is something that is embedded in the Tunisian society. So I don't fear this for the future of Tunisia. I believe that this terrorism might cause some problems in Tunisia, but I'm sure that the future of Tunisia is going to be different from all the Arab region, and it's no wonder that it has succeeded so far, because it has a strong, resilient civil society. It has a history of tolerance, and its Islam is totally different from the Gulf region, so it's going to succeed. And during the years of Bourguiba and also Ben Ali, because political parties were forbidden, civil society has flourished, has become resilient, it has worked, and it has helped in the revolution, and it's also helped in having a new progressive constitution. It has succeeded the four elections, the first election, parliamentary election in 2011, and two round presidential election and a legislative election, and all these were very transparent for the first time in Tunisia. So this is something very important. We have the responsibility to succeed that, but all I believe that we have accepted to have the World Social Forum for the second time in Tunisia, because we believe that the cause of Tunisia is not the cause of the Tunisian people. Now, the problem of terrorism is not a Tunisian problem. It's a world problem. Remember what happened in in the United States. Remember what happened in France no less than 2 months ago. So it's a problem that attacks every part of the world, and the world has to face that, civil society, political parties, governments, and all this they have. Now, we don't have to point fingers to say, now look what is happening to Tunisia. Now, we will have to say that what happened in Tunisia is what is likely to happen elsewhere in the world, and terrorism does not know any frontier. And now we have, at the same time, to build democracy and at the same time to try to fight this scourge that is attacking all over the world that has nothing to do with tolerant Islam.
Well, clearly, though, this will be a blow to the Tunisian tourism industry, do you think?
I believe so. Mm-hmm. I believe so. But maybe also it's going to unite people inside Tunisia to try to find a solution to what is happening also at the same time. I know there's going to be a blow because tourists, whenever they see something that happens in the country like this, they are going to turn it in their minds twice before coming to Tunisia. But that's something part of the loss we are going to have. But anyway, there is nothing we can do, and that's the strategy of the terrorists: is that they give a blow to tourism, they give a blow to the economy of Tunisia. They try to send a message to say that this democracy that you like to build, this transition which you like to succeed, is not going to succeed, and we are here to spoil everything. Maybe they succeed this year, but I'm not sure that they are going to succeed in the future. I believe in the future, and I'm by nature optimistic.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Molly Lewis. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time.